Chapter 4. Life Goes By. Benjamin's many new interests helped him to sometimes forget about his growing unhappiness at home. He started playing golf and was extremely successful. He also took up dancing, and success was at his door again. In 1906, he was an expert at the Boston. 2 years later, he became a star at the Mashish, and in 1909, his Castle Walk made every young man in town envy him. His rich social life had an impact on his work, of course, but who cared? He had already worked hard in his wholesale hardware business for 25 years. He could now pass it on to his son Roscoe, who had recently graduated from Harvard, couldn't he? Benjamin and Roscoe were often mistaken for each other, in fact. Benjamin was secretly glad of it. He had soon forgotten that scary feeling he had felt some years before, just back from the Spanish-American War, and totally loved his looks. Just one little issue ruined it all. He hated to appear in public with his wife. Now that Hildegard was almost 50, even looking at her made him feel ridiculous. A few years later, after Roscoe Button was made manager of the Roger Button and Company Wholesale Hardware, on a nice September day in 1910, a fine young man who looked 20 entered Harvard University in Cambridge as a freshman. This time, he did not mention the fact that he would never celebrate his 50th birthday, nor that his son had graduated from that same institution 10 years before. Lesson learned. He was admitted and quickly became popular, maybe because he seemed a little older than the other freshmen, who were all about 18, but mainly because he played a brilliant football game against Yale. His extraordinary energy, speed, and cold anger made him score 7 touchdowns and 14 field goals for Harvard, and he even had the entire Yale team carried off the field, one by one, unconscious. He was the most celebrated man in college. However, strangely, it was very difficult for him to enter that same team in his third year. The coaches said that he had lost weight, and some, with particularly good eyes, even noticed that he was not as tall as before. He made no touchdowns, surprise, surprise, and the team kept him only because they hoped his reputation would scare and confuse the Yale team. In his senior year, he could not get onto the team at all. He had grown so thin and weak that one day he was taken for a freshman. He felt so humiliated. Everybody thought he was a sort of genius, a senior who could be no older than 16, and more often he was shocked at the worldliness of his classmates. His studies got harder, too difficult for him. He had heard about St. Midas Preparatory School and decided to enter himself there when he graduated, hoping that life among boys his size would be easier. Benjamin finally graduated in 1914 and went back home to Baltimore with his Harvard diploma in his pocket. Hildegard was living in Italy at the time, so Benjamin went to live with his son, Roscoe. He was welcomed back, of course, but there were no warm feelings on Roscoe's part. Actually, he even felt that his teenager father could somehow be in the way with his adolescent mood changes. He was married now, had a good reputation in Baltimore society, and wanted to keep it. No scandal linked to his family was acceptable. Benjamin was no longer the star at dances or college parties, quite the contrary, in fact, and felt lonelier and lonelier. Just 3 or 4 young boys of 15 living in the area spent some time with him. The idea of going to St. Midas came back to his mind.
"Look,"
he said to Roscoe one day,
I've told you many times. I want to go to prep school.
Well, go then,
replied Roscoe shortly. He didn't want to talk about it and hoped to end the discussion.
I can't go alone,
said a desperate Benjamin.
You'll have to take me there for admission.
I haven't got time,
said Roscoe, sharp and rude. He got upset, looked uncomfortably at his father, and added,
Actually, you'd better stop with this fantasy of yours and put an end to this story right now. You better.
Roscoe's face turned all red while looking for words.
You'd better turn around and start back the other way. I don't find this game funny anymore. It has gone too far and has to stop. You behave yourself.
Benjamin looked at him, almost crying.
And another thing,
continued Roscoe.
When guests are in the house, I want you to call me Uncle, not Roscoe, but Uncle. Do you understand? It looks stupid if a boy of 15 calls me by my first name. Perhaps you'd better call me Uncle all the time, so you'll get used to it.
He looked at him seriously, meaning all those words, turned and left. Benjamin could do nothing but sadly go upstairs. When there, he looked at himself in the mirror. He had not shaved for 3 months, but there was nothing serious to remove. When he had come home from Harvard, Roscoe had suggested he should wear glasses and a fake moustache. For a moment, he had feared he would have to live the farce of his early years again, but the moustache irritated and embarrassed him so much that his tears finally convinced Roscoe to give up, though not gladly. Benjamin opened a book of boys' stories, The Boy Scouts in Bimini Bay, and began to read. But he was constantly thinking about the war. Just a month before, the American army had joined the Allied forces in Europe, and he wanted to join them too. However, what a pity. He did not look 16, and he was 57. Not admitted in either case. Too young or too old. Someone knocked at the door, and soon after, the butler appeared. It was a letter with an official logo. For Mr. Benjamin Button. He was so excited. He opened it with enthusiasm and read it with pleasure. It said that many officers who had served in the American-Spanish War were being called back into service with a higher position. He would serve as a brigadier general in the U.S. Army this time and had orders to reach his base immediately. Benjamin jumped up with joy and could not believe his eyes. This was what he had wanted. He took his cap, and 10 minutes later he was in the large tailor shop on Charles Street, asking for his military uniform to be made, in his child's treble voice, but nonetheless there. "You want to play soldier, son?" asked the clerk, joking. Benjamin got angry and replied arrogantly,
"Don't you mind what I want? My name's Button, and I live on Mount Vernon Place, so you know I can afford it."
"Well," admitted the clerk, unsure, "if you can't, I guess your daddy can then."
Benjamin had his measurements taken, and a week later his uniform was ready. Without a general's badge, however. He had some trouble getting it, and the tailor insisted that a nice YWCA badge on the uniform would be just as smart and much more fun to play with. Benjamin didn't say anything to Roscoe, and one night he left the house and took the train to Camp Mosby, North Carolina, where his soldiers were waiting for their general. He arrived on a hot April day. After paying the taxi which had driven him there from the station, he turned to the guard and said confidently,
"Call someone to get my luggage."
The guard looked at him, uninterested.
Well, well, where are you going with that general's costume, son?
Benjamin, veteran of the Spanish-American War, replied with fire in his eyes, but, unfortunately, in a weak, high voice too.
Come to attention,
he tried to shout. He took a pause to catch his breath. Then he saw the guard coming to attention. Someone was obeying his orders, at last. His smile of satisfaction disappeared as soon as he turned back and saw an impressive colonel on a horse. It was not he who had inspired obedience after all.
Colonel,
said Benjamin in his treble voice. The colonel came up, stopped his horse, looked down at him, and asked kindly,
Whose little boy are you?
I'll show you darn soon whose little boy I am. Now get off that horse.
Benjamin replied, furious. The colonel laughed very loudly.
You want him, eh, General?
Here,
Benjamin cried desperately.
Read this.
And he threw his official letter toward the colonel. The colonel read it. He could not believe his eyes.
Where did you get this?
He asked, putting the document into his own pocket.
I got it from the government, as you'll soon find out.
You come with me, said the colonel with a strange look. We'll go up to headquarters and talk about it. Come along.
He turned and began walking his horse to headquarters. At that point, Benjamin and what remained of his pride could only follow him, while, however, promising himself the most severe revenge. But that revenge never took place. On the contrary, 2 days later, his son Roscoe turned up from Baltimore, hot and angry from the unexpected trip, and escorted the crying general, without uniform, back home. In 1920, Roscoe Button's first child was born. During the celebrations that followed, nobody considered it polite to talk about the thing, that the dirty 10-year-old boy who played around the house with toy soldiers and a mini circus was in fact the new baby's grandfather. Everybody liked the boy's fresh and happy face, which only showed just a touch of sadness. But to Roscoe, well, it was a source of torture. As Roscoe's generation would say, the situation was not efficient. It seemed to him that his father, in refusing to look his age, 60, had not behaved like a real man, Roscoe's favourite expression, but in a curious and perverse manner. Just thinking about the matter for as little as half an hour drove him mad. He did believe that lively people should always keep young, but that young, well, it was inefficient, and that was his final opinion. 5 years later, Roscoe's little boy was old enough to play childish games with Benjamin, while the same nurse looked after them. Roscoe took them to kindergarten on the same day, and Benjamin found out that playing with little pieces of coloured papers, making chains and beautiful designs, was the best activity in the world. Once he was bad and had to stand in the corner. He cried then. But for the most part, the other days were spent happily in the cheerful room, with the sun shining through the windows and Miss Bailey's kind hand sometimes resting in his untidy hair. Roscoe's son went to elementary school after a year, but Benjamin stayed on in the kindergarten. He was very happy. Sometimes, when the other kids talked about what they would do when they grew up, a shadow crossed his little face, as if, in a confused, childish way, he realized that those were things he would never share. The days went by, each and every one similar to the previous one. He went back to kindergarten for the third year, but now he was too little to understand what was going on. What were the coloured papers for? Why was everyone so much bigger than him? He was afraid, and he couldn't understand what the teacher was saying anymore. He was taken from the kindergarten, and his nurse, Nana, in her blue and white cotton dress, became the centre of his little world. On sunny days, they often walked in the park. Nana would show him a big grey monster and say, "Elephant," and Benjamin would say it after her, just to repeat it aloud over and over while being undressed for bed.
"Elephant, elephant, elephant."
Sometimes Nana let him jump on the bed, which was fun, because if you sat down right in the middle, it would bounce you up on your feet again. And if you said, for a long time while you jumped, you got a very funny sound effect. Another game he loved was hitting chairs and tables around the house with a stick, saying,
"Fight, fight, fight."
When there were guests, the old ladies would speak to him with kindness, like mothers, which was nice, while the young ladies would try to kiss him, which was a bit boring instead. And at 5 o'clock, at the end of a long day, Benjamin would go upstairs with Nana, who fed him porridge and nice soft foods with a spoon. Nothing disturbed his childish sleep. There were no memories of his brave days at college, or of the brilliant years when he had won the hearts of many girls. There were only the white, safe walls of his crib, Nana, a man who came to see him sometimes, and a great big orange ball that Nana called Sun and pointed at just before going to bed. When the sun went down, his eyes were sleepy, and there were no dreams to trouble him at all. The past, the wild battle at San Juan Hill he had led, the first years of marriage, when he had worked until the sun went down every day in the busy Baltimore for his young Hildegard he had loved so much, the days before that, when he had sat smoking late at night in the dark button house on Monroe Street with his grandfather. All these memories had gradually disappeared from his mind like thin dreams, as if they had never existed. He did not remember. He did not remember anything clearly. Had his milk been warm or cold the last time he ate? What had he done that day? There was only his crib and Nana's familiar presence. And then he remembered nothing. When he was hungry, he cried. That was all. Days and nights passed. He breathed, and over him there were soft, unclear voices that he found hard to hear. And there were slightly different smells, and light, and darkness. Then it was all dark, and his white crib, and the dim faces that moved above him, and the warm, sweet smell of the milk disappeared completely from his mind.